Last time we left, we were talking about the program called Check Input, which I used as an example of a program that would use a do loop. Just to remind you again, the do loop is very similar to a while loop, except for the fact that it checks the condition at the bottom of the loop rather than at the top of the loop. So that unlike a while loop, which if the condition is initially false, we won't go through the loop at all, in the case of a do while loop, it is always executed at least one time. Now in this case, the secondary purpose of this program was to talk about the concept of a robust program. And a robust program is a program that you would write keeping in mind possible bad inputs and try to plan for at least some reasonable strategy to handle it. It might be printing an error message and stopping. It might be printing an error message and continuing along. But a realization that sometimes the input is not what we expect and that shouldn't crash a program is a very, very important point in programming. And in scientific work, as I mentioned last time, when you are processing data, one of the things that you learn in whether it's chemistry or physics or biology is to learn to look at the data and decide which data is real, which data is just an artifact, a mistake, what can be rejected. There are statistical techniques for doing so. And that works into also the case of a robust program. So just to review this program one more time, to illustrate how it works, I wrote a little main, which is really not very useful other than to test the check input function. In this case, the main asks the user to provide a lower and upper bound of what's reasonable data. So you would put in two numbers. Now, by the way, you notice that even here, I'm not doing completely robust. For example, this program assumes that when I ask you to put in two numbers, a lower and upper bound, that you give them in the right order. If you were to provide them in the wrong order, this program would totally not work. You might want to try what happens if you put in the number 50 and 10 rather than 10 and 50. And the whole program would screw up. So this is a perfect illustration where I don't have a completely robust program. But the reason I do that is because the main here is really not a useful program. It's just used for testing purposes to test the check input. But that's a perfect example of, in a real program, of just because you ask someone to provide you a lower number and an upper number, doesn't necessarily mean that A, they will give them to you in the right order, or B, that they'll even give you numbers. And we'd have to learn how to check for that. That's a little bit more complicated than we can do right now. But assuming that, at least in this case, the person gives us a lower and upper limit, for example, 50 and 100, then we jump to the function check input, and that function will guarantee that a number that you enter will be between those two limits. How will it guarantee it? Because it will simply be a pain in the neck. It will ask over and over and over again until such time as you do it correctly. So the loop here receives the lower and upper value that you provided in the main, comes into the loop. Since this is a do loop, it will do this once, no matter what. So it asks you to please enter an integer between lower and upper, between the parameters that you supplied, the two values. You now provide a value. And it's a good idea whenever a program does something like this to give the user some advice about why their value is no good. It's very, very frustrating to sit in front of a computer, put in some values, and the computer just beeps and doesn't say, what's wrong? So we always should provide an error message. So if the value that you provided is less than the lower, we'll print out too small and try again. Else if the value is greater than upper, we'll say too large and try again. And we will continue to do this, to ask for numbers over and over and over again, while the value is less than lower or the value is greater than upper. As soon as this condition becomes false, when you actually provide a good piece of data, then it'll drop out of the loop, return that value to the main, which can print it out. So this way, there's no way of getting out of this loop if you don't give me a number that's between the lower and the upper value. So that's an example of a robust program, and that's an example of the use of a do loop. Any questions? Let's look at another example. Don't look at your sheet right now because that will spoil the solution. Suppose I give you a number, like 4,297, and I want to know how many digits there are. In other words, I want the computer to print out the number 4. If you give me 365, I want the computer to print out the number 3. So how would you go about doing that? I'm going to give you a number. You're going to see in, pick up a number. And how many digits would you have? How would you figure that out? Anybody think of a technique? Remember, you can't just count the numbers because you're not reading them in as 4,567. You're reading it as a number, as a concept, and it's a value. It always adds a digit. But we don't want to add a zero. We want to count how many digits there are in 4,976. You're close. Go ahead. What happens if you take 4,976 and divide it by 10? Integer division. What do you get? Maybe I better put down that number because I'll forget my head what number I was talking about. 4,976. If you divide this by 10, integer division, what do you get? No. By integer division. You get 497. And if you do that again, good. If you do that divided by 10 again, what are you going to get? You're going to get 449. And if you do it again, what are you going to get? 4. And if you do it one more time, what are you going to get? You're going to get 0, right? So if I do this while the number is greater than 0, how many times will I have gone around this? 4 times. And if I put a counter in there, then I'll know how many numbers there are. So my technique is simply going to be, you're going to give me a number. I'm going to enter a loop and successively divide the number each time by 10 and do that while the number is still greater than 0. Put a counter inside the loop. As soon as I drop out, I'll then be able to print out the counter. Let's take a look at that program. You have that in your handout. I think it's called Count Digits or some such thing. Or maybe not. It's called Digits. Let's look at the program. Very simple program. We'll have our original number, input number, a counter, number of digits. We make sure to make this an integer. Please enter an integer. See in input number. So you give me 4,976. Do input number slash equals 10. What does that mean? Let's remind yourself what that statement means. What does slash equal mean? What do all the slash operators mean? Do you remember? X slash plus 5 is the same thing as what? Of X. X plus slash 5 is the same thing. What do I do? What am I writing slash for? X plus equals. That's what I mean. Plus equals. What does that mean? That's the same as saying X equals X plus 5. Okay, it's a shortcut. What does Y plus equals 6 plus X? What does that mean? It's the same thing as saying Y equals Y plus 6 plus X. And so the statement X slash equals 10 is the same thing as X equals X divided by 10. Okay, remember that set of operators? Okay. So what I'm doing here is I'm dividing 4,976 by 10. And since it's integer division, the result of that is 497. And that gets put into input number. Number of digits plus plus. Come around the loop again. And we keep on doing this over and over again while the input number is not equal to zero. The minute we hit zero, we'll be out of the loop and we'll print the counter. So let's take a look at, let me run that program just to show you that indeed it runs. Please enter an integer, 4976, and it has four digits. We'll run it again, put in whatever that, 56,789, it has five digits. Let's just put in one more case, six, and it has one digit. Okay? So, again, a simple example of a do-while loop. Successfully divide by 10 while we're greater than 0, while we're not equal to 0, drop out of the loop, and print the counter. Any questions? Just to illustrate the use of the do-while. Little homework assignment for you, which I will not collect, but something that you should do, because it may appear on exam occasionally. If you recall, way back in your notes, we wrote the Fibonacci program. Okay? And in the Fibonacci program, there was a while loop. Rewrite that program using do while instead of a while loop. And make sure it works. Print it out. Make sure that it works. There's no doubt that you'll probably have questions, and there are several of them in the exercise book that ask you to take a while loop and convert it into a do while, or a do while and convert it into a while. Remember the main difference. The do while will do it at least once, no matter what. The while loop may turn out not to do it at all. So your code has to take that into account. Okay. Yes. What? If you have a while, then, and you just write while input number not equal to zero, it may not work. Correct. It may not work. You see, it won't count right by one. It will be one off. You just simply can't just take the while and put it instead of the do. There's a little change of logic, and I think I gave it to you the other day, the different how to convert one into the other. I showed you when they were what's equivalent, but you have to just think about it when you take a program and turn from one into another. Okay. We are going now to start talking about functions in a lot more detail. That's the next sort of topic that we're going to look at. We'll review some of what we've talked about functions and then take it further. And a particular assignment that you have to do today is, the assignment that you're currently working on should be, it involves writing a lot of functions, and therefore you should be able to do this. Let's just see, what is 2 weeks from today? Well, today's Wednesday, so that's not really fair, but let's see, that would be, so we'll make it due April 10th. So this is homework number 4, and it will be due April 10th. Write a function. All we're doing now is writing a single function to determine whether a year is a leap year or not. Now, the first thing when you write a function is you have to ask yourself, what information do we need to provide to this function? I'm going to write a function. What do I have to tell the function? No. Not the method of finding it. That's when we write the function, we'll deal with that. But what piece of data do you have to provide the function in order for it to determine whether something's a leap year or not? The year. Exactly. You've got to tell what year you want. So our input to the function, and it's a good idea always to make yourself a little list. The input to the function is the year. And what is going to be the output to this function? What kind of answer do we expect? So what kind of answer is that? True or false? Okay? So we want an output to be a Boolean value. So we're going to give it 2008, and it's going to tell us back true or false. So to start writing such a function, once we have that information, we can now right away write the header to the function. So the function is going to be bool, because it's going to return true or false, and we need to give this a name. What should I call this function? Give me a name. Leap year. Okay, good name. Except that we have a standard that Boolean functions start with the word is. So that we'll better say is leap. True or false. It's like sort of a statement, is leap. So I will call this is leap. And I'm providing it int year. Okay? So there is the function. Of course, now we need to figure out how, if I give you 2008, to determine whether it's a leap year or not. So now I turn back to you and ask you, if I was to give this a number to you, how would you know whether it's a leap year or not? Please don't say look it up on a calendar, because that sort of defeats the purpose. Where did they get it from? No, what did they teach you back in high school? How do you know whether a year is a leap year or not? Was the year 2008 a leap year? Was the year 2007 a leap year? How do you know? Well, that's a good truth. It comes every 4 years. But where does it start? Well, was 2006 a leap year? That's an even number. If it's divisible by 4, which means, another way of saying if it's divisible by 4, if the year mod 4 is equal to 0. In the where? Oh, absolutely not. Which now leads me, you gave me a perfect opening to tell you a story. Okay? And a better question is to tell you that the rule that you've just stated to me, divisible by 4, is wrong. It's the rule they teach in schools, but it's wrong. Okay? The real rule is as follows. A year is a leap year if it's divisible by 4, unless it's also divisible by 100. Unless it's also divisible by 400. Okay, here it goes again. A year is a leap year if it's evenly divisible by 4, unless it's also evenly divisible by 100, in which case it's not a leap year, unless it's also divisible by 400. That means the following. The year 1600 and the year 2000 were leap years because they're divisible by 4, but they're divisible by 400. But the year 1900 and the year 1700 and the year 1800 were not leap years, even though they were divisible by 4. Most people don't know that because most people don't care, but it became very important, the year 2000, the year 1900, to know, which were, you know, recent history, to know whether or not those years were leap years or not. And the year 1900, even though it was divisible by 4, was not a leap year. A lot of people who wrote software didn't know that fact. And either they made 2000 not a leap year because they knew the rule vaguely in their mind that every 100 years you don't have a leap year, or they made the year 1900 a leap year because they didn't know the rule that 400, and so they screwed up. Now, where did that rule come from? Where did this rule come from? Yeah, but that would just mean that I just divide by 4. Where does the rest of the stuff come from? Okay, so the answer is a little history. It's not quite science, although it does deal with astronomy, but we'll talk about it anyway since it's interesting. Why did people have calendars in the first place? Who needed calendars? The ancient Greeks and ancient Romans divided the year into 12, but not evenly, as a matter of fact. Why was a calendar important? If you were considered to be an old person by the time you got to 30, not by today's standards, but most people died by the age, you know, the average, you know, lifespan of people. One out of every 4 women died in childbirth in, you know, 1,000 years, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. So why would you need a calendar? You're not interested in history. I mean, who had time for history? First of all, most people didn't know how to read or write. So why did they need calendars? Before that, why do they need to know the seasons? To harvest. That's it. They needed to know when to plant and when to harvest. And since the average farmer, which meant 99.9% of the world's population, was illiterate, okay, and the months of the year were not set at any particular number of days as they are today, what would happen is the local priest or whoever would look out the window and say, it's time now to start planting. And since everybody knew that, let's say, May was planting time, speaking of, okay, so he would say, we're going to declare that on Tuesday will be May 1st, we'll bring some sacrifices, we'll make a big deal of it, everybody will see, they'll start planting. And so they would adjust, the priests would adjust the calendar as they needed, by adding, that's what the Ides of March, and I, you know, all these things that you read about, it was, they would just create months, big months, small months, they'd create it on the spot. Okay? And that's the way calendar systems worked for a long time. They never cared about the year, because who cared about the year? Years are only important for history. In other words, what year is it? And if you didn't live very long, and if every 4 years one king would kill another king and start everything all over again. So if you look at ancient contracts, they would say, in the year 4 of Pharaoh XYZ, you know, in the year 7 of Julius Caesar. And they would just count things by whoever the current king, that king gets his head chopped off, and they start again. Okay? That's the way the calendars were originally. Okay. Now, comes roughly the year 1500 BCE, and the Jews decide they need a real calendar. So the problem is that the Jewish calendar system is based on, like the Muslim calendar, the Jewish calendar system is based on the month, so rather than on the sun, or on the moon rather than on the sun. So we know the sun goes around the earth 365 and a quarter days, but the moon goes around the earth 29 point something days, and the Jewish calendar is based on the lunar cycle rather than on the solar cycle. Okay, so you look at the moon, you see a new moon, you say, this is the first day of the month. 29 days go by, someone comes and says, I saw the new moon last night. New month. And that's the way the Jewish calendar was roughly at that time period. Only one problem is that you have certain holidays that have to come in the spring, and certain holidays that have to come out in the fall. For example, Passover has to be is a spring holiday. So, since the spring, the seasons work by the sun, and the moon, but the calendar worked by the moon, they didn't mesh. And eventually, if you just look at the moon, 29 days, eventually your calendar is so screwed up, and Passover would come out in the middle of the summer, or maybe come out in the winter. That would screw up our vacation. So, what would we do? So they had to do a leap year system. Now, the difference between what we have leap years now is we add a day every four some odd years. The Jewish calendar adds a month. Every few years it adds another month. So instead of having 12 months in a year, you have 13 months in the year. And it turns out that it's 7 out of every 19 years, by some complicated calculation, they add another month to the year. This year happened to be a Jewish leap year, so we had an extra month, which makes the winter a little bit longer, and therefore everything comes back together again, everyone lives happily ever after, and this calendar will work for the next 5,000 years, everyone's happy. Okay, so we've got a calendar that works based on the moon, the lunar cycle, and we fix it up with adding extra months, and now the seasons work, the moon, the months work, everyone's happy. Good. Everything's fine. Meanwhile, the Greeks continue their calendar of, January, using the months, January, February, those are all Greek Roman names, Greeks and the Romans, and they have a calendar, and they realized even then that you had to, that the earth is not 365 exactly, but 365 and a quarter. So they came up with a system. They eventually sat down and said, we're going to make the months 30-day months and 31-day months and so on and so forth. And every 4 years we'll add an extra day. And that works out, and that's called the Julian calendar, after Julius Caesar. Okay, not the calendar we use today. It's an original calendar, okay, that added one day every 4 years to the calendar. And that worked out pretty nicely for a few hundred years. Now, roughly in the year 0, Jesus was born, give or take a few years depending on the history. And Jesus came to the Jewish people and he says, I'm giving you a New Testament. Most of the Jewish people told him, no, I don't want to listen to you. So Jesus went to the Romans. And eventually in your history, you know, there was a thing called the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. And he converted the Romans, and that's where Christianity got its start. Naturally, he's going to use, as a calendar, if you're talking to the Jews, you're going to use the Jewish calendar. If you're talking to the Greeks and the Romans, you're going to use the Julian calendar. That's fine. So he took the Julian calendar. However, he had to decide when to celebrate Easter. Or Christians had to decide when to celebrate Easter. The problem is that what does Easter commemorate? The resurrection. And right before that, Jesus had the Last Supper. Right? And what was the Last Supper? It was a Passover Seder. You remember, at that point he hadn't yet gone to the Romans. And it was a Passover Seder. That means, historically, Passover and Easter have to come at the same time. Otherwise, when you go to the Romans, the story doesn't match. How would it be that the Jews are having Passover 1 month and the Christians are having another month if it's supposed to, everyone knows that Easter and Passover are supposed to occur at the same time? Plus the fact that it would cause Brooklyn College students a tremendous amount of difficulty when we don't know when to make spring break, because Passover and Easter would be at two different times. And this year, actually, is a perfect example. Because this year happens to be a Jewish leap year with an extra month, Passover and Easter are far apart, about a month apart, and so you guys got off for Easter, and we got off for spring break, Passover. It's great. Now they just have to add one more holiday, and we'll be, everyone will live happily ever after. We'll have a lot of vacation. So there was an issue. Okay, the issue was that the two holidays had to come at the same time. Now, of course, they started their calendars roughly the same time, and for a few years, everything worked out reasonably well. But because the Julian calendar added a day every 4 years, and that's not an exact calculation, by the time they got to the 1600s, the calendars had moved 11 days apart. Okay, because the conventional secular calendar added a day every 4 years and didn't take into account the little bit more that it takes the sun to go around the earth, and therefore eventually it accumulated, so one calendar is 11 days ahead of the other calendar. And no longer are the two holidays at the same time. Not only that, because by the time the 1600s they really didn't worry too much about the fact that the two holidays didn't come at the same time, but the seasons were beginning not to be correct. Easter, which has to be in the spring, supposed to be in the spring, was already moving away towards the summer. It was 11 days ahead of itself. And they realized that if they kept on going, soon Easter would be in the middle of the summer. And worse than having Easter in the middle of the summer is having Christmas in the spring, because then you wouldn't have snow. And that whole part wouldn't work together. So Pope Gregory had a contest of all the wise men in the kingdom, I guess, how to fix the broken calendar. So they sat down and they decided, if we add a day every 4 years, and we take away a day every 100 years, and we put back a day every 400 years, the calendar will work perfectly for the next 5,000 years, by which time we don't care about it anymore. And that's what they decided. And that's called the Gregorian calendar, which is what we use today as a secular calendar. Now, by then it was already 11 days off. What to do? Well, if you're the Pope, you just make an announcement that anyone who prints up a calendar next year should have November 2nd on the calendar, and the day after November 2nd should be November 13th. They just threw away 11 days. So the calendar of that year said November 2nd, November 13th. What did they do with all the people who were born in between? I don't know. What did they do with their birthdays? But in any event, it was fixed, and everything works out fine, and the two calendars, the Jewish calendar and the Christian calendar, the secular calendar, works together. And that's where we get this rule from. Interesting side note. First of all, the Muslim calendar, as far as I understand, is a lunar calendar and doesn't work with the seasons. So the holidays revolve around the year. Am I correct? So sometimes you have the holidays in the winter and they move on. It's based purely on a lunar calendar, and it never made the correction. Okay, there was no correction for seasons. I suspect, among other things, was since that started out in an area, like in a desert-type country, where seasons weren't that important, because it was, I guess, hot all the time. And therefore you planted or didn't plant And therefore seasons weren't as important. So it became the lunar calendar. There was no reason to fix it up with the and they certainly had no reason to fix it up with the Christian calendar of the day, because they disagreed with them on so many things. So therefore they have the lunar calendar, which is fine. People who live in the Soviet Union, or people who are in the Greek Orthodox Church, you may know that their Easter and their Christmas are not the same days as the traditional, the Gregorian calendars. It's a little bit later. Why? Because by the time Pope Gregory came around, you know from your history, the Greek Orthodox Church wasn't talking to the Pope. There was a split. Remember the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. And to the Byzantine Empire and the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, which was that part of the country, the Pope wasn't important to them. In fact, he was evil as far as they were concerned. And so they are still using on their religious calendar the original Julian calendar, even though it is not exactly correct because of the extra day every 100 years or so that's added in. But that's fine, because they don't have to keep their stories together with anyone else. So they use the original Julian calendar. The secular today, the majority of the Christian world, the secular calendar uses the Gregorian calendar. The Jewish calendar uses their system. The Muslim calendar uses their system. And hopefully everyone lives happily ever after. The point is that calendars are just made up. Days are just for counting. So whatever the rule is, okay, it's just a calendar. Okay? So this bizarre rule, which is really bizarre, add a day every 4 years, take it away every 100 years, put it back every 400 years, it's just a rule that is an accounting system. That's what it is. It's an accounting system to keep track of the passage of time, consistent, so that the sun and the moon all run around, you know, the earth, vice versa, or the earth around the sun, and keep everything working. In any event, we need now to take that statement. A year is a leap year if it's divisible by 4, unless it's divisible by 100, unless it's divisible by 400, turn that into a C++ statement, so that given the year, out comes the true or false. And so I will do it as follows and let you figure it out. Now I need a little bit more, it's a big statement, so I'm going to raise this for a moment. I'll do it with one statement, which I'm going to put in here. But I'm just going to start writing it over here. Return. Single statement. Return the result of the following calculation. Year mod 4 equals 0. That says, that's true if it's the remainder is 0. The year is unevenly divisible by 4, false otherwise. And year mod 100 is not equal to 0. Or year mod 400 equals 0. That statement, and you should verify it at home with the order of operations, which seemed to give some people trouble on the exam with Boolean numbers, will return true for things like 2008, 2012, 2000, 1996, 1600. That will all give an answer of true. But the year 1700, the year 2007, 2009, and 2100 will return false. Put the numbers in at home, check your order of operations, and you will see that this will be true if you give it one of those, and false if you give it one of the others. Any questions? So that's a simple function that is given, in this case, a particular input, and it then goes ahead and returns a result. Now, have we changed in this function the word, the value in what's in year? Has year been changed at all when we operate this function? No. Year is unchanged because all we do is we examine it and say true or false. Any questions? 2004 is a leap year. 2008 is a leap year. 2012 is a leap year. I didn't give you the whole long list. I mean, just said, here are some numbers to try out to see that you understand how the true-false works. Excellent. Okay. Now let's look at another function. Slightly different. So I'm going to erase this. And this, by the way, you don't have, these two you don't have in your handouts, so you should have been copying this down. Write a function that prints the date in the form dd slash mm slash yy. In other words, if today's date would be written in this format, would be 26-03-08. Now, that of course is not the way you normally see dates written in the United States, but this is the way you see dates written in Europe. There are many different ways of writing dates, and what we would like to do is, we were designing programs, we want our program to be international, that it would run in any location. So instead of building this Intel program, we write this as a function so that when you go to Europe, you use this function. When you go to the United States, you just rewrite the function and all your dates would come out. When you install Microsoft Office or Windows on your machine, it asks you what country are you in. And if you say you are in the United States, then it uses dates, English dates, and it uses the dollar sign in the cents. If you say that you're in Europe, it uses the euro instead of the dollar sign. It prints the dates, what Americans call backwards, and it would use, let's say, instead of using commas in every thousand, it might use a space or a period, depending on which country you particularly live in. Okay, that's called localization of programs. Localization makes a program work in different locales, in different countries, which is very, very important in the world today. And especially if you want to make money, you want your program to be used comfortably by anyone, anywhere that you sell it to. The best way to do that is to gather up all the things that depend on the location into small functions. So that as you move from country to country, all you do is replace one function with another. If this was throughout your entire program, you'd have to rewrite the program from scratch. This way, you just replace the function for the European or the American date, and it'll print it out automatically using that function. Now, by the way, while we're talking about dates, which is not directly related to this program, let's talk a little bit about this date. Americans write the date as 3-26-08, right? Europeans write this way. As usual, the American way makes no sense, because it has the month, then the day, then the year. It's not in the right order. In other words, we say March 26, 2008, while in Europe they would say it's the 26th of March, 2008, which makes sense. It goes from little to bigger to bigger. So this makes sense, this doesn't make sense, but such is life. Lots of things don't make sense. Americans still don't use the metric system. That's, you know, we're just dumb. That's the way it is. Next. Truth of the matter is that for computers, none of these make sense. Why do none of these make sense? Well, very often you want to sort something by date. You want to sort things by date. Like, I want to get everyone in the class and from youngest to oldest. If you sort these things by date, it won't work out right. Because although January 1st, 2009, comes after December 30th, 2008, but if you sort them, one comes before 12. So it would say that this is comes first and this comes last. So when you sort dates, if you use either of these formats, you don't get the right things sorted in the proper order. So there's a third format, which is a format you begin to see more and more often, and that's to do it this way. 08, 03, 26. Year, month, day. If you now sort anything this way, anything in 07 is going to come before anything in 08. So when you write computer programs, and later on we're going to talk about how to sort numbers and things, you have to keep in mind that different people sort things. If you sort this just plain, it doesn't come out correct. It's not the right order that you would expect. In any event, I want to write this program. So what should be the input to this program? What do I have to give this program to do its thing? If I wanted to print out the date in that form, what information do I have to give it? What does that mean? The year, the day, and the month. Okay. So the input will be of the form int year, date, and month. I'm going to provide it three pieces of information before, in order for it to do its thing. What does this function return to me? What does it output to me? Well, I asked this function to print something. Look at the way the function is written. The function is to have a C out and print something. When it does that, does it give anything back to the main program? The function, think back to our prompt user. The prompt user function printed a message on the screen. Did it give anything back to the main program? No. It just did its thing and it quit. In other words, this function will have void for its output. Because it will do a task, but it won't give me back a number. Unlike the other one. The one we wrote before gave me something back. True, false. It gave me an answer. Square root returns a value. You give it a number, it gives you back the square root. This function, the prompt user function, don't give us back anything. They print a value, and then life goes on. So it's going to return void. So let's write the function header for this, which again is not very difficult. It's going to be void. Let's call it write date. You've told me already that you're going to provide me with the year, month, and day. So int day, int month, int year. And the only thing this program is supposed to do is say C out. It's going to print the day followed by a slash followed by a month followed by a slash followed by what? The last two digits of year. Unless we decide that we want the whole year, in which case I just say slash y. How will I get the computer to print only the last two digits? Yeah? If I take any number and divide it by 100, what will be the remainder? Take the year, take the number 537. Divide it by 100. What's the remainder? 37. Take the number 2976. Divide it by 100. What's the remainder? 76. So if I say year mod 100, it will print out the 8 from 2008. Now, it's true, I really wanted to print out 08, and in this case, it'll just print out 8, but I'm stuck with it for now. Make that a little more complicated and say if the number is less than 10, print a 0, else just print the number, but for now, we'll just do it this way. Okay? And then, we have the word return, which just returns and doesn't return anything. Now, actually, the word return here is sort of optional. Because if you leave the word return out, C++ will put it in for you anyway. It'll provide it for you. Because when you're returning void, essentially it means go home. When you get to the end of the function, you go home. But it's a good idea to put the word return in to explicitly say, I'm going home at this point. Okay? Does anyone see the difference, contrast these two functions? The first function we wrote returned a value. The second function did a task rather than perform, do some kind of value. Okay? And all of our functions will be in one of those two forms. Either they will give us back. Now, a function can only return one value at a time. Okay? Like the last one, return true or false. Only can return one thing. What happens if you have to return more than one thing? We've got a problem. We'll have to deal with that shortly. Okay? So a function can either return nothing, in which case it's a void, or it can return one value, in which case we say it's either int or float or whatever it is that it happens to return. Ever got that concept? Why use functions? Well, first of all, because I said so. And you'll lose points if you don't, especially in an assignment that says use functions. That's number one reason in your mind. But there are actually some good reasons for using functions, so I'm going to give them to you. Of course, when you first start writing programs, it seems that it's more trouble than it's worth, which is true. When you first start, you're writing baby programs, you don't see the advantage of writing functions. But when you will be start writing, even in your next class, programs that are several hundred lines long, then you will see that functions will make your life a lot easier in the following four ways. Number one, it saves coding effort. What does that mean? It means that once you write a function and you know that it works, you can use it in other programs. Copy it over, just cut and paste, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel each time you write a program. And if, for example, now that I've given you this function, if you ever have to write a function with a date, you just go back to your notes, copy it, and it'll work. End of story. The same thing with you write a program that deals with leap years, and you have to know whether something's a leap year or not. You remember, back in your mind, someone wrote you a function that does leap year, you won't have to rewrite it from scratch each time. So it saves you coding effort. The second reason is it reduces total programming time. Now that sounds like the same as the first one, but here I'm talking about the real world. In the real world, programs are not written by a single individual. They're usually written by a team of people. Here, if you, a team of people wrote a program, it would give you all zeros. But in the real world, programs are written as by teams. Hundreds of people, maybe even thousands of people sitting down. Each one has to write an individual piece of a program. The only way to do that is to have the programs be written in a modular fashion, like Lego toys, where different blocks each go together. In the same way, in the real environment, each team or each individual in the team is given a task to write a function to do the following. And if they write them itself and copy their little functions, the system analyst or the designer or the team leader can then take all the pieces, put them together, write the main, which will then call the functions to do it. So in order to promote good teamwork, good group work, we use functions. Next, very important even for you, it eases debugging. It makes it simpler to find your mistakes. Even today when you have a large program, the programs that you're writing are getting bigger and bigger, and you have errors, it's hard to find out where the error is in the program. If each function is written individually, it could be tested. You write a little baby main just to test this. Once you're sure it works, you know the error is not there. So it eases debugging effort, which is very, very important. As a general rule, no program or function should be more than one side of a paper, including comments. So if your programs are taking up more than one sheet of paper, which is roughly 60 lines, including the comments, it means break it up into smaller functions. Okay, no function, or even the main, should be bigger than a single sheet of paper, including its comments. That's a rough guideline for telling you what's called a chunk. Okay, another way of looking at it is that a function should do one task and one task only. Okay? So you should be able to say in one sentence, this function prints the day in day, month, year format. And that one sentence becomes the comment for that function. The main has a big comment, because that's to tell you all about the whole purpose of the program is. Each function, one line across the top. This is what the function does. If you have to write a paragraph to describe what a function, break it up into two. Another good guideline to use. A good executive knows not to do any work. A good executive knows how to delegate. A main should do no work. A main should call functions. Call the input, get the data. Next function, process the data. Produce the output. There it is, the whole main, three statements. Now each of those in turns are functions. And the get data function might be, have several parts. Open the file. Read the data. Check the data for error. Send the data back to the main. And each of those tasks could then be further functions. That's called top-down design. The main is like the executive. Build an apartment house. That has several components. Foundation, walls, electrical system, plumbing system. No one could be an expert in the whole thing. Take the electrical system. That has several different wire up the house, put in the outlets, put in the switches, so on and so forth. So the contractor, okay, calls these different subcontractors, who each call subcontractors to do their work. That's called top-down design. That's the way programs should be structured. Finally, writing programs using functions simplifies program maintenance. Now, what does it mean to maintain a program? I mean, you maintain an apartment house. You maintain your room. What does it mean, maintain a program? In school, you write a program, blood, sweat, and tears. You finally get it working. You give it to me. I give you the grade. You either hang it up on your refrigerator or not. And you never want to look at it ever again. Right? You say, that's it. It works. Goodbye. That's it. But in the real world, programs are dynamic living things. Con Edison, huge programs for billing. Every once in a while, they decide that they need to change how the bill looks. Every once in a while, they need to change how the bill is computed. Programs have to be modified. And often, the person who's modifying the program is not the person who wrote it. In fact, most programmers today don't write original programs. They work on existing programs and they modify them. I'm not going to rewrite an operating system like Windows from scratch to make Vista. They're going to take the core pieces of it, add new pieces, modify some of the old pieces. But in order to do this program maintenance, if the program was just one big thousands of millions of lines long, nobody would be able to figure out. It's bad enough if I ask you to look at your program a month after you hand it in and try to figure out what it did. You wouldn't remember your own twisted logic. Let alone if you didn't write the program in the first place, and you had a program that was, 10,000 lines long, and I said, now make this change to it. First, you have to even figure out what the program did. By writing the programs into separate modules, into separate functions, you can figure out, oh, this is the function that produces the bill. Everything else doesn't change. I'm going to rewrite that one function so the bill looks different, on different size paper, or now provides electronic, or sends it to you over email, or whatever. That little piece has changed. So since programs are dynamic and they're constantly changed and they're constantly modified, we want to be able to simplify their maintenance. Now, eventually, you're going to work for a company, or you're going to be a scientist, and you're going to create a library of functions that you use all the time. Let's say you're a chemist doing some research, or a physicist, or a biologist. You're going to create a set of functions that do the things of work that you constantly are calculating. So you're going to create a little library called a biology library, or a chemistry library, or a physics library, with all the routines that you've developed, or for that matter, you may buy some of them from someone else. You will then simply include them in your program, number sign include, so that you won't have to write them from scratch. You'll just be able to use them, they've been developed either by yourself or by someone else, use them, and then write your program to call, you know, to do the actual computation. So functions is extremely important, and from this point on, every program that you submit, especially including starting with the one that will require the use of functions. Now, I've also mentioned to you that every time you use a function, you need to include a function prototype. Okay? What would the function prototype be for this function? If we wanted to write this as the prototype that we include in our program, what would it look like? Well, you know how it looks like. It just takes out this and puts a semicolon. That's the function prototype for the function that we just wrote. What's the purpose of a function prototype? Well, the simple purpose right now is so that when we link, remember this thing, the step called linking? First, we compile. We compile means we translate the functions into intermediate code, into machine code. But then they've got to be put together. And there's a step called building, which includes the compile and the link step. Remember, we talked about that. Well, how does the linker know that the pieces match together? That the functions are being called in the way they've been designed? That's the purpose of a function prototype. A function prototype tells the system, the linker in particular, what information is required to come in and what information is expected, if any, to be produced. So that if we would call this function in the main and we'd only give it a day and a month but not give it a year, the linker would say, that's not the way this function was written. This function is required to have three values. So it helps the system put the pieces together, and it helps us because if we misuse a function that we've written, it will call us on it and say, you've written the function one way, you've used it a different way, and they don't match. Okay? So every program has function prototypes. Where do the function prototypes go? Well, we've put them so far in the declaration of the main, right? We have main, then we have variables declared, then we put function prototypes. That's where some people put them. But as programs get bigger and bigger and bigger, lots of people like to put the function prototypes up on top. After the number sign includes, using namespace standard, then go all the function prototypes that your whole program is going to use. Then comes your main, then comes the functions, or vice versa, then come the functions, then come the main, that's up to you. And that's how we would structure a program. That way, when someone reads your program, they say, number sign include the math library. Oh, I know they're going to use the math library. Number include standard I.O., and then they have the function prototype, so right away it puts in your mind, these are the different functions this program is intending on calling. Then comes the functions themselves and the main. Eventually, the functions won't even be there. They'll be in a library that you've written and saved separately, and you'll number sign include it. So the prototypes will still be there, but in the main, or in that file, there won't even be the actual functions. So this calls attention to the fact that the program is going to use the following functions. Okay. We're going to pause with function prototypes, with functions for a moment, and move into a slightly different area of programming now. We'll be coming back to functions shortly, probably tomorrow. Up until now, we have been focusing on processing numbers. Integers, floats, doubles. Yes, we've printed out things like words and quotes, but we haven't actually processed, done anything with those other than number data. We're going to start by looking at what we call character processing. And character processing deals with the processing of a single character. Not a string, which is double quotes, like your name, but a single character at a time. A single character is represented with single quotes. Now, right away, something comes up that is a little bit bizarre. When we were processing numbers, and you typed in 365, and then the next number, 92.7, and you said C in X comma Y, you read in the 365, you obviously ignored all these blanks, and then you read in the Y, which is 92.7. In other words, the purpose of these blanks was nothing more than to separate one number from another number. And it made no difference, I showed you, whether you have multiple blanks, or you have one blank, or you even put these two numbers on separate lines. The purpose was just to keep them apart from each other. But when we process characters, we're not processing numbers anymore. We process the three, not as a character, but as a symbol. We process the six, not as a number, but as a symbol. And the five, and the blank, and the blank, and the blank. Each of these are now legitimate characters. So we need to start keeping in our mind, is there a blank there? For that matter, what is there after the seven? Well, it depends. Did you hit your space bar five times? In which case, there are five blanks there. Did you hit the enter key? If you hit the enter key, there's an invisible character there, which you can't see, but I will represent it by writing as angle bracket CR, which means carriage return. Or, did you hit the tab key? Now the tab key looks like it produces four blanks or five blanks, but it's very, very different. Four blanks, you had to hit the space bar four times. So there are four blanks in that space. If you hit the tab key, there's only one character there. That character we call slash T, which then tells the system to make believe it's four spaces. But what's really there? One character. So complicating our processing of characters is we have to stop thinking about things as words or as numbers, but think of them as a string of individual characters. Now, there are two broad categories of characters. Those that you can see and those that you can't see. Those that you can see, A, B, C, D, F, G, question marks, punctuation marks. And there are those that you can't see, but they're real just the same. A blank is such a character. Actually, they have a name. It's called white space. White space are characters. They really exist. They're really there. They're no different than the ones you see with your eyes, but they are sort of invisible. White space characters are the blank, the carriage return new line, and the tab. Those three have the special name called white space, and they'll be treated somewhat differently. The what? No, control Z is not a character. Remember, control Z is the only character that's not a character. It's the bumper at the end of the track. It's not the track. It signals it's all over, but it's not a real character. Okay, just like the bumper at the end of the tracks is not a track. Only trains can go only on tracks. They can't go on bumpers. When they hit a bumper, it's all over. So, having said that, let's look at some simple programs and see if we can explain what they do and then write some more complicated character processing. But always remember, you're not processing individual words anymore. You're not processing numbers. You're processing individual characters in the file. Okay, if you will turn to your program called Copy File. I think it's called Copy File 1. I'd like you not to look at the sheet right now. And before I explain to it, I want to run it. Does anyone have it? When I say not to look at it, it means look for it. Okay. Darren, it's before that, I think. It's a small little nothing program. Okay, let's run this program first and see what it does, and then we'll figure out how it does it. So I ran it, and it just sits there, and I'm going to type something. The cat in the hat, and I'm going to verbalize, I'm hitting the enter key. The sun did not shine. Okay. It was too wet to play. So we sat in the house. All that cold, cold, wet day. Okay, from The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss. Okay. What did it, does it appear that this program is doing? I typed the line and enter. What did it do? It copied it right out. Now, you only a single letter, X, Y, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I put in a character, it spits the character out. I put in a character, it spits the character out. I put in a character, it spits the character out. Now, why did it not spit the character out after the first T of the? It didn't spit it out until I typed the whole line. Remember that the computer is not paying attention to what you're typing until you hit the enter key. All of that is going into what we call a buffer. A buffer is just a temporary space in memory that as we type, the buffer begins to fill up. Computer's busy doing other things. It's thinking deep thoughts. It's thinking what it's going to do on its vacation. It's not paying attention to anything we say until we come ahead and hit the enter key, which essentially is kicks it in the shin and says, wake up and pay attention. So input, as far as the computer is concerned, is not coming from that keyboard that you're typing. It's coming from this buffer. And every time you hit the enter key, it now takes one thing out of the buffer at a time and sends it to the screen, as you can see over here. So what I call this program copy file or copy or whatever, because what it seems to be doing is whatever I'm typing, it's echoing it back out. A character at a time. Not a line at a time, but a character at a time. In fact, if I hit a space, watch, space, enter. It hit it, it printed another space. Space, enter. Blah, blah, blah. Lots of spaces. Blah, blah, blah. Okay? It's taking a character. Think of it. Take a character, spit it out. Take a character, spit it out. That's what the program is doing. The fact that you don't see it spit it out until I hit the enter key at the end of the line is simply because I have to wake the computer up to look at the buffer. But it's really going into the buffer and taking the character. If I can create a buffer without the enter key, I could then, you'll just see one character time coming out, 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 out. Okay? Everybody with me? Now, why does it start a new line after this Y? I hit the enter key after this Y. Why did it start a new line after this Y? Because the new line is a character just like the Y is. It's white space. So it actually read that new line character, just like it read the Y and spit out the Y, it then read the new line and spit out a new line. And when you spit out a new line, what do? You go to the next line. Okay? So here, even the new line, even the blanks, are treated as characters. Now let's look at this program. Oh, how do I say I'm all done? Control Z. At this point, I say, Control Z, leave me alone. Goodbye. Let's finish. Could you use any other trailer? Would it be possible to use any other trailer? No, because whatever you typed in, it would take a character and spit it out. Whatever you put in, it would spit it out. So I need to somehow or other use something that's not a character. And the only thing that's not a character is Control Z. Let's look at the program. Again, forget about this business argc that's not even there. Okay. Now, for a moment, let's ignore the fact that I'm declaring a variable called C to be int. Let's imagine for a moment that I declared the variable to be char, which is what it probably logically should be, since I'm processing characters, C-H-A-R. There's a reason why I had to write int here, but for now, make believe it says C-H-A-R. We'll come back to it later. Let's look at what this program does. It says, while not cin.eof. We've seen this many times before. Cin, of course, is the keyboard. It's a file as far as the computer is concerned. And it means, while not cin.eof, means do this over and over and over again until you hit the Control Z. This is a C idiom, something that you should start recognizing in your dreams. When you see, while not cin.eof, your mind should say, process characters until there are none left. Okay? So if I tell you to do something, I give you a file and say, process this file until it's all finished, while not cin.eof. That sort of phrase will stick in your mind as being the loop that says, process everything and everything and everything until there is nothing left over. Okay. Let's see, what do we want to do? So I introduce here two new methods. Remember what a method is? A method is something that's defined as something that the CEN is capable of doing. The CEN, for example, can do an EOF. EOF is a method. It checks and says, did I reach the end of the file? Here's a new method that CEN recognizes. It's called the GET. The GET method. We don't call this a function, we call it a method. That's just terminology, but essentially it works the same way. There is a big difference between them. We'll talk about that near the end of the semester. But for right now, GET. What do you think GET does? Exactly. We now know EOF, we know dot open, we know dot close. So we know three methods. Now we know a new method called GET. Now what does GET, you think GET does? It goes to CEN and gets the next thing it sees. Whether it's a blank, whether it's a letter, whether it's a tab, whether it's a number, a digit, a character digit, the very next character it finds, including blanks, that now blanks are legitimate characters. The next thing that it sees, it gets it. So when I say C equals CN.get, it gets whatever character I typed in, like the T from the cat in the hat, the T. It gets it and puts it into the variable called C. Simple? Not using CN with those angle brackets anymore. Those read numbers and they read strings. This is very simple. Get a character. One character. Don't think about whether it's a number. Don't think about whether it's a space. Just get it for me and put it into C. C equals CN.get. And now another method called put. Put is given a character, the one I just read in, and puts it back into a file. So when I say cout.putc, since cout is my screen, so C was a T, so now it gets put to the cout. But there's a big difference. The angle brackets can't pick up the spaces. Right? When you say CN, angle bracket X, angle bracket Y, it reads the first whole number you see, skips all the blanks, and then reads the next. It's no way that those angle brackets can read those blanks. So if I want an exact copy of a file, I gotta use get and put. Because only get and put will pick up individual characters as I type them in, blanks at all. So it's going to substitute for those, but they work very differently. Another thing is, when you say CN angle bracket X, and you write the number 346, it looks at the 346 and says, that's 346. It turns it into a number. This doesn't turn it into anything. This would get, if you wrote 346, what would it do? It would get the 3, then it would get the 4, then it would get the 6, then it would get the blank afterwards. Each time you call it, it gets the next character, and it doesn't convert it into anything. Big difference. The angle brackets do what human beings do. They look at three characters, oh, you're a number. They look at a bunch of letters, oh, you're a word. Okay, they put that logic together. But sometimes we don't want to process things that way. Sometimes when we want to make exact copies, is we need to pick up each individual character one at a time. That's what CN does. CN is sort of raw input. And cout is the same thing. It's raw output. It takes a single character and sends it to cout, the put. So as you can see, what does this program do? Very simply, until there are nothing left to process, it gets a character and puts the character out. Gets the next character, puts the character out. Gets the next character, puts the character out, forever and ever, until there are no more characters. How does it know there are no more characters? When you hit the Control Z. Okay? Now, very simple program. Make sure we understand it. So all this thing does is it takes whatever I type and sends it to the screen. That's because CN was the keyboard and cout is the screen. So it takes one at a time, out, 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 there's nothing left. Make sense? Yes? Okay, now, let's talk about the variable C. What has to be inside the variable C? What am I putting into the variable C? A single character. A single character at a time. When you say char C, you're creating a variable that can hold a single character, which is all that we're doing here. How big is that variable? How much space does the computer have to set aside for a variable that's going to hold a character? 8 bits. 8 bits, or 1 byte. Right? Because there are 256 different characters, numbered from 0 through 255, and a number, what we learned in binary, that can be held in 256 has to be 8 bits, 2 to the 8th power, 8 bits. So when you say char C, it's a spot big enough to hold one character. Okay? However, that's not the only thing that we might want to put into this variable. Sometimes we want to put a control Z into the character at the very last time. And a control Z is not one of the 256 characters. So a control Z would not fit into a char. Since we're testing for control Z, we have to prepare a little bit more space in the computer than an ordinary char would put in. And therefore I have to call it an int, which gives it more space. So the general rule is as follows. When processing characters, if the only thing you're ever going to put into the character is a character, then you declare it to be char, C-H-A-R. Some people call it char. I mean, different people have a different way of pronouncing it. However, if it's possible that a control Z could be put into that space, then you have to declare it to be an int. Another way of looking at it is if you're going to use the .eof on it, then this has to be an int. Because .eof works with control Zs. Control Zs take up more space than ordinary characters do. The reason why is not important. You'll talk about that in CIS 15. Forget about it for right now. But if you use EOF for the character, then you need to declare it to be int, even though logically it should have been created as a char. In all other cases, we would leave it as char C. And you'll see we'll be very consistent. Sometimes we'll declare it as char. You'll see that I won't be using EOF. If I use EOF, I have to call it int. Just a separate rule because of the fact that control Zs do not fit